Welcome to Headlines. This is David Lichtenstein, your host. And this week we have a wonderful show. We are going to have with us Rabbi Chaim Jachter, who is the Rav, the Sephardic Rav of Shari Oira in Teaneck. He's a member of the RCA. He's a Chaver Bezdin of Elizabeth, New Jersey. We will also have Rabbi Yitzchak Grossman, who's the Reish Chabura of Great Washington. He's formerly a Bezdin of Bezdin Meisharim in Lakewood. We will also have Dayan Yaakov Rappaport, who's both an attorney as well as a Dayan. And the topic is going to be the Y chromosome, the Aaron HaKoyin chromosome. You know, a well-known Israeli geneticist discovered that most Kehanim, this is 98.5% of Ashkenazi Kehanim, have a certain chromosome, and we're going to be discussing what happens if a Kohen does the blood test and he finds out he doesn't have it. Well, should he still go up for Birchas Kohanim? Can he be somebody for Pidyon HaBen? Additionally, can he marry a Grusha if he falls in love with a Grusha if he doesn't have it? So we're going to have these three very respected Rabbanim discuss this topic. We'll also be discussing with them DNA and halacha. What is DNA's attitude towards halacha? You can listen to us always on WMCA or WMCA.com. You can listen to us also Monday morning at NachumSiegel.com at 11 a.m. You can always listen to us on our phone line at 732-806-8700 or podcast at headlinesbook.com. If you have any questions, you can email them to us at info@headlinesbook.com. Before we go to our guests, I would like to discuss something that happened this week. You know, most of you have heard, I'm sure all of you have heard, that Eli Wiesel, the great author, passed away this week. And to most of the world, he was sort of a symbol of the generation of the Holocaust, who, I understand, less than 100,000 Holocaust survivors are alive at this time. He was a young boy. I think he was 14 or 16 at the time. And he died. He was in his late 80s. So it's a momentous occasion, notwithstanding the individual, but the metaphor for what he stood for. And in my eyes, it's possibly, borrowing a line from Tom Brokaw, they were the greatest generation, because we looked at these old, wizened people struggling with all their, you know, paranoia and other illnesses many of them had. But think of it, what they went through to come out normal, to come establish families, communities, shuls, to build Eretz Yisrael, after what they went through, the Shiva Madura Gehenim, they were truly the greatest generation to maintain their emuna. Do you know that in Yiddishkeit, in Judaism, there are three different ways to describe a cemetery. One is Beis HaKfaris. It's also called a Beis Olam or a Beis Olamim. Additionally, it's called a Beis HaChaim, a house of the living. And when you think of it, it's a commentary, and I heard this far from a Rav in Florida. It's a commentary on the three different lives people live in this world. Some of us live very corporeal, physical, good existences. We eat good food. We live good lives. We drive fast cars. We lead a good life. And when such people die and they put them in the ground, it's called the Beis HaKfaris. They're buried. They led a nice life, a good physical life, and they're buried, much like you would bury anything that dies. And then you have another type of person. You have a person who lived a good life, but he also fed the other part of him, called his neshama and his soul. And he was mekayim ramach mitzvah asei, and he heeded shasa mitzvah leis asei. He fed his soul. He nourished his soul. He led a spiritual life as well, a meaningful life. He davened. He prayed. He learned. He kept the Torah. Such a person, when they bury him, it's called Beis Olam, a house of forever. Such a person will get up by Tchiyas HaMeisim. The Gemara says in Sanhedrin, when we bury a person like this, it's like burying a seed. Ultimately, it will sprout. And when you plant a seed, it sprouts something much greater than the seed. Comes from the ground after you water it at the end of time. So for this person, he will live forever. And then there's something greater than both of these, the Beis HaChaim. And that refers to a person, he lived a good life, and he lived a spiritual life, but he also did something else. He was an influencer. He affected the lives of others. How was it? He inspired. His actions caused others to look at him and to say, wow. Or he built something that continued past his lifetime. He created a legacy, something that carries on past his life. And what do we say about such a person? It's not just a Beis Olam, it's a Beis HaChaim. It's a home of the live, because that person is still alive. The Gemara says in Tainus, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, he says, Yaakov Avinu, our great forefather Yaakov, he never died. So the Gemara says he didn't die. They buried him. They wrapped him up. They chaited him. They mummified him. They put him up. They put all the different types of potions, and they put him in the Maras HaMachpelah. They were makoined him. They lamented him, etc. What do you mean he didn't die? So the Gemara says no. Mazari b'chayim, afu b'chayim. His children are alive. They're following in his ways. They're saying his thoughts. They're living his lifestyle. They're passing on his teachings. So too is he alive forever. He was an influencer. The Gemara says, halachically so too. Do you know, here's an interesting opinion. The Gemara says that it's Yalkut Shemayni in Tuf Kof Mem Dalet. It says that when Rabbi Akiva died, Eliyahu HaNavi came. Remember, Rabbi Akiva died a horrible death. They combed his basar, Masmer Shel Barzel. So it says when he died, the Romans had his body. And Eliyahu came, the prophet Elijah, and he carried his body back for burial. So they asked, but Yalkut Shemayni says, Eliyahu was a Kayin. He says, no. Rabbi Akiva, even a Kayin could be Matamatu because he was considered alive. And Taisvis says, Taisvis in Ksubis, I think it's on Daf Kuf Gimel, brings Rabbeinu Chaim Kayin, he says, I would have been Matama for Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam, the greatest influencer of his generation, the Ran says on him, Kol Chach Midoiru wa Kekwipas Hashum Negdai, he says, I would have been Matame. There are people like Rabbeinu Tam, or people who influence others, whose words, whose actions they pass on. You could be Matame. Mahu b'chaim, avzari b'chaim. That means they really are alive halachically. Now, this is disputed. Many Paiskim say, look, it's considered they're alive, but really on some level they're dead, so we're not Matame. Most Paiskim agree with that. But others don't, and they say, we take it really literally. So what do we say about the Holocaust generation? Most of them are gone, but we would not be here if it were not for them. It's truly Mazari b'chayim afu b'chayim. We have to look at them as truly in Judaism, going back certainly thousands of years, maybe to the times of the Churban. They were the greatest generation to come back from what they saw, to maintain their faith, to rebuild, to remarry, to have that courage. The greatest generation, one of their great icons has passed, and they buried him, as they buried the rest of them, in a Beis HaChaim that live forever through us. Let's go to our guests. Introduce you, okay?
Okay, excellent.
Let's see. I don't know how well you hear me. It's a little bit. He says the recording is coming out very good, but I'm in Alberta. You're in New York, so. But he says he hears it very clearly. Okay. We have the honor of having with us on the phone Rav Chaim Jachter, who's the Rav of the Sfardik Shul Shari Oira in Tinek. He's a member of the RCA and a Chaver in the Beis Din of Elizabeth, New Jersey. He's also a Rebbe in TABC. And the author of many Sfarim, welcome Rabbi Jachter.
A pleasure to be on. Thank you for having me on your show.
So, Doctor, I know you've written about blood tests and DNA and halacha. So this is a sort of a new wrinkle in it. They've now a professor in Israel, Carl Skorecki, has rather controversially come out with, you know, the theory that you can now test the Y chromosome of Kohanim to see that that's the paternal, that's only from the male. And he, according to, and this is the, I'm getting this from Wikipedia, 98.5% of Ashkenazi Kohanim and 100% of Sephardi Kohanim have a marker called XDE. So here are three questions I'd like to pose in order. Number one, a Kohen comes to you and he says, Rabbi Jachter, you know, you're the Rav of the Sephardi Shul of Tinek. And guess what? I did a test, and it's 100% of Sephardi Kohanim have it, and I don't have it. So should I do? I was honored to do a Pidyon HaBen next week. Should I do it or not? How would you respond?
Wow, that's a nice shaila. The shaila is, I would say to him that he can do the Pidyon HaBen, and that the Rabbanim just generally say that Yichus is determined. Ish mipi ish, we have a Mesorah that goes, if it goes from family, if they're from, they have from parents, from children, from parents, from children through the generations. And that's how we determine things. We have, that's how our Kohanim today are called, Kohanei Chazaka. It's a Chazaka based on what has been transmitted midor lador. And you have to be skeptical about these findings, especially it can be reversed, and it can change. Science is very subject to change, as Postkim have already noted, going all the way back to the time of the Rivash.
Even though we know, for example, the Gaon was paid himself numerous times. We don't know how many times. They say wherever he traveled and he found the Kohen, he would be paid himself, because he said, we don't know for sure Yichus today. And he wanted to be sure that he was Niftik Halacha. So he continually did it. So he clearly felt that there was a suffix by both Kohanim.
Correct. But the Aruch HaShulchan says, Chas V'Shalom, to call into question our Kohanim. Araya, the Kohanim, they do make a bracha by Pidyon HaBen, and they do make a bracha when they duchen, which shows you that, as the Chassam Sofer already points out, that our Kohanim, even though it's only from a chazaka, it establishes a vados. It establishes a certainty that we know who's a Kohen.
So the question is, would a Y chromosome be enough to make a reyes on the chazaka, given that it's a rave of a high 90s%, as Stella was saying? And it's Ruba v'chazaka, Ruba Adif.
Okay, but we have to be very skeptical whether this is really proven. And let's see how the science is going to play out.
Let me ask you another. Let me extend the question, Rabbi Jaster. Let's say this same Kayin now wants to go duchen, and somebody makes him aware that Rashi Shita is that a zar that's oila for duchening is over an iser asay, right? So the question is, he says, you know, now there's a ruba that a DNA. This fellow said that I'm not a kain. Every time I'm oila to be duchened, it's child that I'm over an iser. But frat the kainet by svardim, they do it every single day. He says I could be over hundreds of iserim a year. What would you tell this guy?
Stay the course. That he should not be deterred from the course based on the DNA evidence.
Rabbi Jaffa, let me ask you a question. Would you be simich on DNA in halachic matters? I know you've written about it. So let's say two children come to be Irish, and one brother says, look, I happen to know my mother was having an affair at the time, and I have a lock of my brother's hair. And he says, I sent it into three different laboratories blind, and they all came back, and they said, it's not my brother. How would you respond to that case?
Well, I'll tell you. Let's talk a little bit before we get to the Yerusha case. Let's just talk about how DNA is applied, at least for Aguna. So you are right that the Rabbanim do accept the DNA testing, at least partially, to be Matir Aguna, as happened in the situations of the
World Trade Center.
Of the World Trade Center, exactly. At the World Trade Center, Aguna, they were Matir women. But there's a different story, because to be Matir Aguna, Chazal in general will more make on the Rayos that we'll accept. We'll accept Aid Mipi Aid, we'll accept from people...
Karev, and Isha, Apostle, and Akka, Mashtar, etc.
Correct. So here we can accept DNA evidence to identify the remains of a husband. But this, in terms of determining why chromosomes, I don't know. It just doesn't. This is what determines kahuna. It just seems to be too much up in the air. It needs to be much more testing to know for sure that this is even to be taken into consideration. Halakhically, as far as kohanim are concerned, I would say that to be Matir and Aguna, that's really an exceptional situation. Even for Yerusha, not really Koveya. Someone's Muksa because of Yoresh, they want to remove someone from the Yerusha based on the DNA evidence. Already we have a psak from Rav Osner that we don't accept the DNA.
And what's the bait? What's the svara behind it?
The svara behind reasoning? It is, the svara and the reasoning would be very, very simple. You know, when we have chazakos, we have this is the way halacha operates, and you're gonna start with DNA. And who knows if it's true? Who knows? Mayu Adyom? Who knows what the science say 10 years from now, 20 years from now, 100 years from now?
So you think DNA is subjective and could be changed?
Not too convinced that DNA, quite honestly, is going to be changed. But look, sokhlin v'sofen al chazakos. Chazakos are very, very powerful. But in terms of DNA evidence of kahuna, trying to identify that somebody, we can know who's from Aaron Cohen based on DNA evidence. That I'm pretty skeptical about. DNA.
Well, I agree with you, and it's very unclear. It's almost like. It's some are calling it junk science. It's uncertain to say you take a group of people and say they all have common, there could be mutations over time with a chromosome. But let's go back to DNA and Rav Buzner's psak. You have two siblings, and scientists will tell you the chance of them having of the son who does not have the DNA of his father is 1 in 100 trillion. The FBI says.
Right.
So that means, to give an example of 1 in 100 trillion, would be the equivalent of somebody taking millions of letters, putting them in a bag, and shaking them out. And where he shakes it out, it creates the book Word and Peace, with all the punctuations, the paragraphs, and the syntax exactly. That's the odds of 1 in 100 trillion. Probably less than
right.
that.
Right. Right.
So,
correct.
They're telling you that they have the DNA is taken from the lock of here by two from a scientist, so the Adis is Neman, or five, and they're saying this is not the brother and he is not the son. Why would Rav Osner say he's a Yerush?
Yeah, it's good kasha, but it was a very brief. I'm looking at Rav Osner's tshuva right now, or at least the presentation. It's a very, very brief description here. It seems to me he's basing on the power of chazaka, and that the DNA is only for the rove, and the rove cannot undermine.
So let me ask you a question according to Rav Osner, okay?
Yeah. a muksak, as far as mama.
A body is found. It does not have a. It's not. You can't identify it. It doesn't have a head. It's a mace. They don't know who it is.
Right.
They do a DNA test and they say, "Listen, bad news. Sarah, this is your husband. He's dead."
Yeah.
Right. She goes ahead and she gets married according to the DNA.
Right.
She's living. 6 months later, two boys come. They say, "You know, we were passing by. We were leaving yeshiva. We were in Brisk. We stopped off in Paris. It was the cheapest ticket on the way back to America. And we're telling you, we saw her husband walking in the street eating a falafel. We're 100% sure."
Right. Right.
So if DNA is like a chazaka, no more, the Edom should be Neman, and the children would be Mamzerim. And the scientist says it's 1 in 100 trillion that this is not her husband.
Right.
What do you say?
Right.
According to Rav Ozner, the kids are Mamzerim from the new husband.
You ask well. You say well. There's no doubt you're saying very, very well. But I hear you. I know. But as far as DNA evidence, as far as Aguna, for sure. As far as Yerusha, we're not going to accept it. I hear. Good cash on Rav Ozner. Yeah. I hear. You like to have a tshuva where you have lots of meat on it and you can see the basis. But here, it's very hard to analyze Rav Ozner's tshuva because...
Let's talk about child support. You're an Av Beis Din, right? You sit on a Beis Din. Mother, a child, they say, the father says, "This is not my son." And he then produces paternity. He produces a lock of hair from the son and he says, "It's not my son, and I don't want to pay child support."
Mm-hmm.
As the Av Beis Din, how would you paskin?
Yeah, if I was on such a case, I would follow Rav Dichovsky. That as far as Mamzerus, that we wouldn't rely on it. But as far as Mamonos, we would say it's a suffix, and the father doesn't have to pay. So the truth is, there was a psak from the Beis Megalim in Yerushalayim, the Beis Me'arurim. They said that they're not going to accept DNA evidence even as far as Mamonos, and they would mechayev the husband stuff. That's a little bit surprising. But lemaisa, as far as Mamzerus, we don't accept DNA evidence. And when it comes to determining child support, it seems to me that Rav Dichovsky has the most reasonable stance.
So I'll tell you,
I was sitting
with a family court judge in the secular courts in New York. She's a Frumma woman.
Mm-hmm.
Her name is Mickey Morgenstern. She's a judge. And I asked
her,
what would you say if you're the judge? And in secular court, somebody comes in, he says, I have DNA evidence that this is not my son and I don't want to pay child support. What would you rule? And she said, I would rule that he has to pay child support. I said, why?
Really?
Because you don't believe the DNA? And she said, no, it has nothing to do with that. She said, but the court does not want to see wards of the state. We don't want to see the destructions of families. You live with this child. You accepted this child. We do not want to accept evidence in this matter, period.
Uh-huh. So that's a secular version of Sokun V'sarfen al Chazaka.
Which
it.
Is not, I understand, there's a psak from Rav Yashiv that's not dissimilar, where somebody was said he wants to do a DNA test, and Rav Yashiv said,
correct,
no, we will not accept the DNA test, which was, we don't want to know.
Well, it's a little bit different. Rav Yashiv said, not that we won't accept the DNA evidence, but he said, don't take the test. So there's already
because we don't want to know the answer, basically.
That's correct.
Which
that's
is
correct.
Very similar to what
don't
the judge
leave
said.
Leave the chazaka alone. Leave the chazaka alone. That's right.
Because I just think that when these earlier rabbanim like Rav Uziel, etc., the Tzitzelias were writing about DNA, it was sort of in its infancy and it wasn't as well tested as it. I think DNA was then where the Y chromosome is today.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But it's,
right.
I mean, to me, DNA is
but
as strong
as... As far as Mamzerus, that already, the threshold is so high to prove that someone is a Mamzer that even DNA is not going to meet that criteria. So forget it for as far as... not to prove Mamzerus.
Well, but for Mamzerus, you have another issue. According to Ramesha and according to others, where it's not necessarily the DNA that produces Mamzerus, but it's a Biyasurat, so that the DNA
that's
can't
correct.
Say proof on.
That's correct as well. Correct. In other words, the DNA evidence shows that the husband's not the father, but doesn't mean,
it doesn't mean
that
there was an illicit relationship. Yeah.
Right, it could be told that the child was produced through artificial means. That's
I don't know. Rabbi Jachta, our takeaway psak from you is that the Kayin should be Eil Leduchen. He should still continue to make Pidyon Abens. He's, of course, offered to marry a Grusha if he falls in love with a Grusha. And as far as DNA and Halacha, we should look at Rabbi Jachta's Halacha files where you tack this issue most competently in four different pieces.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you. It's always, as usual, an honor having you on with us.
Thank you. Could I just add one little
Absolutely.
Piece? Just while I have you and we have this forum, just to say it, that Kohanim should stay far away from a Grusha. They shouldn't, if they fell in love with a Grusha, then I'm going to have to say no. They should stay far, far away and from women that are suros to them and not think that Rabbanim is going to come up with a het there because... It's going down a path that's not going to bring anybody any nacha. So Kohanim should be careful about their yichus and their continuing their chain in Kedusha that goes back all the way to Aaron HaKohen, 3,300 years.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Jachta. All the best.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Kulta.
Shabura. Say it, Reish Habur of what?
Greater Washington Community Kol.
Greater Washington Community Kol. And you were in Lakewood. You were on the Besdin there, some Besdin.
Yeah,
no,
I worked with several of the Batidin Lakes. I worked with. I used to serve on the Besdin Meisharim of Lakewood, as well as the Besdin of the Beis Avad Linyane Mishpat.
Okay. Okay, I'm ready to go. Binyamin, I'm ready to go. Hello?
Yeah.
Okay. We have on the phone with us Rav Yitzchak Grossman. He's the Reish Chabura of the Greater Washington Community Kol. Formerly, he served on the Besdin, Meisharim, in Lakewood. Welcome, Rav Grossman.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
So, Rabbi Grossman, you're aware of the quote-unquote the Aaron HaKohen gene. The Y chromosome that was discovered by a gentleman in Israel, Professor Carl Skorecki, where he notes that the Y chromosome, which is paternally passed down of Kohanim, 100% of Sfardim Kohanim have, Sfardish Kohanim have that, and 98.5% of Ashkenaz Kohanim have that. So I'd like to present to you the following question. A Kohen comes to you. His father was a Kohen. His grandfather was a Kohen. And he says he was tested, and he does not have the Kayin gene. So he wants to know, should he or should he not accept a Pidyon HaBen that he was invited to officiate at? How would you respond?
I would respond that I don't think the findings of Professor Skorecki and later studies would have much impact on the halacha in this case. I'm not an expert on genetic genealogy. I read a little bit about his study and the follow-up studies. My understanding of the numbers is that they are somewhat more equivocal than that. In general, genetic genealogy doesn't attempt to prove definitively whether a certain individual is or is not a descendant of the Y chromosomal iron. It simply tries to establish that a group, a population group having similar haplotypes and haplogroups come from a common ancestor. The probabilities are things like you're twice as likely to have certain genes within if you're a Kohen, you're less likely. But even among the Kohanim, most of the numbers I saw simply are things like 50% or 60% versus 10 or 15%.
Well, I'm just getting mine, Rabbi Grossman. I'm getting mine from Wikipedia. That's my research is from Wikipedia, Y chromosome iron Wikipedia, and it's page 2 of 5 on Wikipedia. That's where I'm getting my numbers from. So I apologize if they're wrong. But that's
I spent
the budget here for research is minimal.
I have the page. I have the chart. You said you're looking at the first column. I'm looking at some of the later columns where they have numbers like 45, 56.
Yeah, but they, in other words, they test 50, they test many markers. This marker was 98. There is one marker that 100% of Kehanim Sfaradim had and 98.5 Ashkenazi Kehanim have.
Yeah,
there are other markers that are less thing. Each one is a different chromosome, a different marker in the gene.
Yeah. Okay. So as I said, I'm not sufficiently expert in the studies and how to interpret them. But my understanding is that given the possibilities of mutations, most of the studies assume that the genes always mutate, certainly over thousands of years. So the fact that someone wouldn't have the gene, is not conclusive due to the possibilities of mutation and recombination. Therefore, I would suspect that the post-Gibbon General, I would be pretty sure the post-Gibbon General would not place too much stock in this. All the literature, all the post-Gibbon who are on record discussing the use of
DNA. Sir, so let me ask you then another question. What is your attitude about DNA? A woman is married, and they find the mace, and they test the mace, and the DNA comes back, and they say it's 100% match to this particular body, right? It's a headless body. They find 100% that this is the DNA. There's no doubt. They bring in three different from a DNA experts. They say this is the body, the DNA. We took some hair from his comb, from his beard trimmer, and from this, it's the same body. Okay. She goes ahead and remarries. A week later, or a month later, or a year later, two adim come, and they say, she remarried? 6 months ago, we saw the same guy walking around in Paris. Mamish, we saw Beryl in Paris. The DNA, we don't know anything about DNA. We were in Paris. We were coming home from the mirror, stopped off in Paris. We saw him in the airport over there. He was walking. What would you say? What's the halacha?
That's an interesting question. I thought you were going to ask me the basic question of would I rely on DNA to matcha vagun in the first place. My answer would have been an unequivocal yes. I appreciate the position of the poskim, such as Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg and others, that the odds are 1 and 12 zeros, that it's a coincidence, and that it's karov levadai, it's virtually vadai, it's certainly a high enough standard to matcha and aguna. You're asking a more interesting question, which is what would we do if we were faced with two witnesses against the DNA. Now, the DNA is never certain. It's always probabilistic. It's always based on the unlikelihood of strange coincidences. So it's always theoretically possible that it's inaccurate, but it's according to many post-Gim, Relyashev is reputed to have held this way, it's a reliable enough evidence to matter in the first place. If you found Adim, so there are Gemaras that indicate that there are such things as presumptions that are so strong, chazakas, and assumptions about how the world works that are so strong we would discard Adim. Whether these DNA arguments, assuming the evidence was so tight, the amount of matching pairs that they found was so high, and the patterns they found were so precise that it was indeed one with 12 zeros after it, that it was unlikely. Would that be enough to actually dismiss Adim? I'm not sure. I would think possibly, but that's a chiddush because there are poskim who are not willing to rely on DNA by itself, who wanted DNA with other things. They apparently didn't feel DNA was at an absolute certainty. So I'm not sure what would happen after the fact if DNA was contradicted by two witnesses.
Because we know that the Tzitz Eliezer, for example, would not use DNA. But it's also possible that DNA was in its nascent stages at that point, and it's become much more, perfected over the last, 30, 40 years or so.
This is absolutely true. The earliest Chuvah, Tzitz Eliezer and others were actually referring to different types of blood typing, and certainly many poskim invoked both certain theological arguments about the Shlosha Shutafin Ba'adam, as well as the fact that they just were suspicious of the science. As you said, it was nascent. Many of them explicitly articulate this. Many of them acknowledge a conservative view that the DNA is still, the blood testing, the different types of forensic tissue testing were still in their infancy, give the science a chance to settle down. So either explicitly or implicitly, I think you're absolutely correct that many of the post-Gim, a big part of their reluctance was due to the fact that the technology was still very young. Certainly the trend in more recent years, what you said is certainly true. Rav Uziel, Tzitz Eliezer, Rav Yaakov Rosenthal, many poskim in the early years were reluctant. Rav Avadia continued for quite a while, saying
to be reluctant
to use it.
Yeah,
On the other hand, many of the more contemporary poskim in the post September 11th attacks, with Zalman Lechemia Goldberg primarily, but again, there are pretty reliable quotes that Rabbi Yashu was willing to use DNA for. For Aguna, there's a famous ruling by...
Yeah, but Rabbi Grossman, respectfully, to be mater in Aguna is a much lower barrier than for many other areas in Halacha. Probably the lowest barrier in either in Evan Ezra or Yair Adeya is Aguna.
Yes and no. Aguna,
I mean,
on the one hand...
Shama Kail Havara, Shama Matza Shtar Be'ir, you have things that would never be accepted. Forget about it. Wouldn't even in Dinim Mominis would never be accepted, a mutter by an Aguna.
Yes and no. It is true. Poskim have acknowledged the tension on the one hand because of the...
Even an Edus Akum is Neman by for Aguna.
This is all true, yes. Poskim have acknowledged the tension between the fact that on the one hand, we lower the standards, as you said, in terms of Hilchos Edus, Afilu Echad, Afilu Pasul, Afilu Mesiach Pitumo, as you said. On the other hand, we're machmer from Mayim Shein Lemsov. Poskim have pointed out that in certain aspects of Aguna we're very stringent about because of the Chomer of Eishes Ish. So you're right. Every different type of question, Aguna, Yerusha, paternity in terms of child support, Avelus, every question does have to be evaluated separately, and each one has its own particular set of rules. So I wouldn't be so quick. You're absolutely right. You have to be careful before generalizing from one type of question to another. But the core arguments made by someone like Rav Zalman Lechemia Goldberg, who's widely recognized as one of the, if not the leading expert today on Chosh Mishpah and Evan Ezer, his basic argument is, it's just a fact. It's so clear. It's just such a conclusive proof that we have to use it. Maybe we wouldn't convict someone of a capital crime and execute him if we had that power based on that, because there, as you pointed out, the standards are exceptionally high. But in general, the standards are... The proof is just so clear that's the view that I personally am sympathetic to. The question of proof is just so overwhelmingly convincing that I think there's a very strong argument that should be made for relying on it in general.
So going back to the case where there was Adam negative DNA, what would be your inclination?
So the first one other point we have to recognize is that when we say DNA, you know, to a layman, DNA is black and white, yes or no. When you read about the actual DNA forensics in courts and elsewhere, there's a whole variety of shades of gray. It depends on how good the tissue samples are, how well the matches are. In theory, DNA can be incredibly precise. In practice, even putting aside questions of error, there was a recent article in The Atlantic, Ravina Lopiansky showed me this, a recent article pointing out the horrors of so many cases where courts were...
Tamper DNA, DNA that wasn't collected properly.
Wasn't collected properly. It was contaminated. It was interpreted incorrectly. In the laboratory and in schools, you can get perfect cases. In the real world, you often have degraded samples, mixed samples, contaminated samples. So certainly, if you're faced with Adam, insofar as any of these things are possible, chain of custody problems, certainly the fact that there are Adam, that he's alive, might tell you, well, let's assume that something went wrong, and we'd have to reexamine the samples. But if even after reexamination, everything is still perfect, and we've showed it to 12 experts, and they're all willing to raise their right hand and swear that this is a 100% black and white, no room for interpretation case, and they were against Adam, I personally might be inclined to dismiss the Adam, but as a question of chum or vicious ish, I'm really not sure what I would do.
Well, let me give you an example of of a case that would be, in my opinion, similar. The Gemara says a case. I think Taisus says this case. He says, if two Adam come and they say, Ruvain Mace, and his wife is mutter, his Reuven passed away, is deceased, and his wife goes ahead and she marries somebody. And then the Adam leave town, we can't find them anymore. And a week later, Reuven, in himself, in his all personal glory, walks into town. So Taisus asks, would the wife be allowed to stay married to the second person? And what's the tzad that you should say yes? Why don't you say it's two Adam, who said Reuven passed away, it's Trey or Trey against two Adam. Who are the two Adam? Everybody who's looking at him was saying he's here. So Taisus says, say it's a Suffolk, and since she got married with the approval of a Beth, and she should be allowed to stay married to her second husband. So Taisus says, something that is so obvious, for that Adam don't make a difference anymore. Adam are a type of a proof. Where something that is blatantly obvious, you can't, how does the old expression from Groucho Marx say, am I supposed to believe you or my lying eyes? If Reuven is here, all the witnesses in the world cannot say that he's dead. So the question is, when the FBI, and this is again coming off of Wikipedia, the FBI estimates that the odds of a coincidental match in DNA could be as low as 1 in 100 trillion. Other estimates, if it's, like you say, if it's corrected properly, and that's a very big, like you say, it's a very big if, could be 1 in 113 billion. Some say as low as 1 in 10 billion. It depends on the quality of the DNA. But my position would be is that if it's being revered that these are the facts, Adam are proof. Adam are better than a simon, that the best imaginable simon, that the best imaginable evidence. When the person is here, there's no evidence, there's no proof, the person is in front of us. And 1 in a trillion means the person is in front of you. Does that sort of make sense to you?
It does, and that's basically the point I was trying to make before. I would, as an example, I would bring another Gemara, even bigger chiddush. The Gemara in Ksuvos talks about the idea that when a woman would get married, there would be a kol as to whether she was an alman or a grusha, or whether she was a basula. Kol hayotzeis, basula nisseis, yotze beinuma, kol ha'isla. The Gemara talks about various umdenas, and the Gemara says if those umdenas are 100%, if that happens absolutely consistently, even if Adam came and testified otherwise, we would dismiss the Edom and we would say, Hani Saad de Shakri. Another Gemara like that in Ksuvah, the Sarbel Chana Wasser makes this point. He says, you see from the Gemara that even when it's not literally the facts are in front of us, you see that there are certain types of chazakas and presumptions that are just so strong, it's just so clear to us what actually happened, we will dismiss Edom who contradict them as they must be lying, even though we normally don't say that. So both in terms of Bahar and Baraglav, the case you mentioned, as well as these cases of chazakas, I absolutely agree that there is such an idea in Halacha that there can be facts that are just so clear and so well established that we would use them to dismiss Adam. The question is, to me, it's a judgment call, given the possibility that the DNA is possible. It's a small chance, but it's possible. It's not, you know, literally, logically, necessarily true. Is that like a certainty, or is that like maybe not? Then we'll allow the Adam to say that this is that kind of 1 in a billion case. I would still be inclined to the position you took, that it's so certain and so clear that we would dismiss the Adam, but I can't be absolutely sure.
So basically, coming back to full circle to our case of the Cohen, you say, until the Y chromosome from our professor in Israel is more perfected, you would put it in sort of like in the category of a science to be revisited at a later date.
And I would say even more than that. I would say that even what the science tells us is that the science knows that there are mutations, and the science knows that it's not 100%, and it's much less than the 1 in 100 billion and the 1 in a trillion.
Yeah, but I'm saying, if it was one in a thousand, or 1 in 100 even, would start having serious halachic implications.
Yeah, but I'm not, you know, opinion of Ben specifically. I'm not sure, but in general.
Well, let me give you an example, Rabbi Gross. Let me give you an example. He wants to go up for Birchas Kayanim, right? According to Rashi, a Zohar that gives a bracha is Iver Nasei. Kaisa Varcho Esbidei Yisrael V'loi Zohar. Rashi holds as a Lav. This Rasei, rather. So if there's a Rav, a 99% chance that he's not a Kayan, would he be allowed to go up for Birchas Kayanim?
It's an interesting question. Nevertheless, the fact that there's a Rav, that, on the other hand, we rely on the Chazakos that he is a Kayan. The Poskim acknowledge.
A Rubava Chazaka and a Rav Gomer is certainly better than a Chazaka Lekuli Alman.
I hear. But, so
if I'm saying at this point, it seems to be possibly as low as junk science, but if it was perfected, it could be problematic.
If it was perfected, if we had numbers of very high confidence intervals, that would certainly allow for the possibility that we have to ma'arar his kahuna, certainly Lechumra, not to allow him to duchen or not to allow him to. Not to use him for building a band. Yes, I certainly can see the possibility.
Well, Rabbi Grossman, as always, it's a pleasure having you on with us. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
Kalta, bye-bye. We have on the phone with us Rabbi Yaakov Rappaport, who wears two hats. He's both an attorney, a practicing attorney at law, and he's also a rabbi and a dayan. And the topic of discussion that we will be discussing with him today is DNA, and in particular, the Y chromosome, the Aaron HaKohen chromosome. Welcome, Rabbi Rappaport.
Thank you for having me.
So, Rabbi Rappaport, as you know, a number of years ago, there was a professor by the name of Carl Skorecki
and a number of collaborators who lived in Haifa in Israel, and they discovered that the Y chromosome from Kohanim had particular, and the Y chromosome, for those of us who are lay people, is a chromosome that only comes, it's paternally, it's from the father, that Ashkenazi Kohanim, 98.5% of Ashkenazi Kohanim had this Y chromosome, and Sephardi Kohanim, 100% of them had it. So here's the question that we've been discussing. Would you, I mean, and Rappaport, by the way, famously, they say the Goyen looked for years to find a Kohen Meyuchis to use to be for Pidyon HaBen, and he used a Rappaport. Are you, by the way, a Kohen?
No, I am not. I happen to be a Levi.
Okay. Well, he used a Kohen. So here's the question I would put to you. If you were being, a Levi doesn't do Pidyon HaBen, but let's say somebody, a Yisrael, wants to do a Pidyon HaBen, and he's using a Kohen whose father was a Kohen and whose grandfather was a Kohen. And this Kohen, as a whim, would go and have his blood tested, and he finds that he does not have the Y chromosome. So therefore, he is in the 1.5% of Kohanim who do not have that chromosome, or 0% from Sephardic, which does Professor Carl Skorecki therefore would say that he does not believe that this person is a Kohen. Would you use that person for Pidyon HaBen for your son? That is the question.
So the answer is no, I would not. But if I used him already, I wouldn't make a bracha on the second Kohen.
Okay, and so elucidate. Give us some clarify.
Let me get clarify over here. You know, Kohanim nowadays is all... The Kohanim we have and we use, the Rambam says there are two types of Kohanim. There are Kohanim Miyuchasim, and there are Kohanim that are not Miyuchasim. The Rambam tells us that when it comes to Pidyon HaBen, we could use a Kohen that even has a general Chazaka. We don't need more than a general Chazaka for a Kohen. But when it comes to eating Truma and Kudshim, we need a Kohen that is Miyuchas, that is not just a chazaka, it's someone who comes in and says, I know you're a Kohen, you're 100% a Kohen. So our Kohanim we use for Pidyon HaBen is all based upon chazaka. Now, I believe and I think that if 97 or 98% of Kohanim have the gene and only a minority do not, that means there's a rove telling us that this person who does not match up to Professor Skorsky's report, is in the mute. And so there's a rove telling us that he's not a Kohen. And we know the famous rule that rove v'chazaka, rove is better. So despite him having a chazaka, and you know his chazaka may give him the ability to eat truma like the Rambam says, I think this rove that has been created, I think that rove would knock out the chazaka, and I think it's a davar pashut that it's preferable not to be used, l'chatchila, certainly.
So let me ask you another question now. Let's assume you have this Kohen, and he wants this Kohen who does not have this gene, that there's a rove, and how high of a rove is it? It's probably a 99% rove. Because it's 100% of Sephardim have it, and 98.5, if you blended it, it's a 99%+ rave. You have a Kohen, he's in that 1% that don't have it, which would say that there's a reasonable likelihood, if this is correct, that he's not a Kohen. He wants to be Oila to Duchen. And we know that, according to Rashi, there's an Isser Asay, right? Kohen Sevarchu Espedei Yisrael, Sevarchu Atem V'loi Zarim. He wants to bench, he wants to go up to Duchen. If he's wrong, he's either, according to Rashi, an Isser of a Zor that's benching. Would you allow him to go up for Berachas Kohanim?
Good question. I think that for me to allow, I think if he would ask me the question, should he do the Berachas Kohanim, the answer would again, I would say there's a role that ruins his chazaka, and it's an established rove, and he could only duchen based on chazaka, and again, ruba v'chazaka, ruba adif. That's what I think. I'm going to say the same sock, because he has a chazaka that his families were kohanim. We have a new rove, there's...
So you would say not to go up. So let me ask you another question now, Rabbi Rappaport. What would you say to this Shaila? I was recently involved in a question where a kain fell in love with a grusha. Let's say this kain was tested, and they found out that he's missing this chromosome. Would you allow him to marry this grusha?
So on that, I would surely say I would not allow, and I'll explain why. Because the rove over here is telling us that he's not a Kohen. But the rove is not going to be conclusive to matir a iser, and I'll explain. When it comes to history behind DNA and halacha, all the poskim, when they talk about the question of DNA, you know, when it comes to World Trade Center shilas, when it comes to paternity questions outside the realm of kahuna, the gedolei poskim are very hesitant to rely on DNA to matir isurim. They do not matir isurim so blatantly with DNA. They use a lot of other heterim as well. For example, all the shutim you could read about the World Trade Center and how we were matir the agunas, DNA was a factor, but according to everyone, it wasn't the final conclusive psak that we could only rely on that. And I think that here too, by the Gerusha, to only rely on that for Yisurim, that would not be enough.
Now, why wouldn't you? Well, DNA is relatively, the accuracy of DNA is improving exponentially over the last number of years. Why wouldn't you be master Yisurim based on DNA?
So it's the following thing, is that, you know, DNA, it's something in we don't have a mesoira in DNA. There's an interesting Chasam Sofer, he talks about esrogim and how we could prove something is an esrog or it's not an esrog. And there's a lot of talk that if it has all the signs of an esrog, well, you know what? Obviously, it's an esrog. I could ask someone who's in the fruit industry, a botanist, and he'll tell me those signs are 1,000% proof it's an esrog. And the Chasam Sofer tells us, you know what? Even if a botanist will tell us it's a 99% chance that this came from the right pardes, that's not enough in halacha, because in halacha we need something more than just, you know, simonim, which DNA would be in that category. We need a mesoira.
So would you use a fingerprint to identify somebody?
So again, the poskim, yes, it would depend. It would be a sniff to a heter in a gunis.
So you would not identify somebody just on a fingerprint? A fingerprint?
It would again. The question: I would identify him in a fingerprint when it comes to dine mominis. When it comes to Ebn Ezra halachas, the poskim are hesitant. So
why? The question is why? Why? Somebody has a complete set of fingerprints on a mace. Why wouldn't you use the fingerprints to identify the person?
Okay, so when we deal with a mace, the gemara, so fingerprints are 99.9% accurate. So again, I would say the same thing like I said with the Chasam Sofer, is that despite us having a high percentage, if we don't have there's a concept we have when we use all our raya's and our proof. When we look at Choshen Mishpat as a whole, and we have all these methods of proof. When we invent a new method of proof that's not found, even if it's a high percentile, it is a difficult and leap bound to say, you know what, is a 99% chance this is correct. Let's rely on it. It's more
fingerprints
than
are not 99. They're 100%.
Fingerprints, I agree they're 100%, but there are, you know, fingerprints, there are good lawyers on cross-examination that can get out of fingerprints. I've seen that. So I agree they're 100%, but who was tested, there are mistakes in the testing and so forth.
But let's assume there are no mistakes in the testing. Why wouldn't you be able to use fingerprints?
Because, again, because I can, if we don't have a mistake, just like this Chasam Sofer.
We have no mistake on, let's say, photography or on lenses. Would you say if somebody's watching a video of something, you couldn't paskin from watching it through cameras or through eyeglasses for that matter because there's no mistake on it?
So I would say it's different. That's a good question. So when I see something in eyeglasses, I'm using my eyes.
Let's say it's through a TV lens. You're watching a camera. You're watching something occur. You wouldn't be able to paskin based on that because there's no mesira?
You see, I think the difference is the following thing. When you have all these methods of proof, DNA and fingerprints, it's type of a third-party proof. I see this fingerprint, and I could recognize that it's his fingerprint. It's not as blatant as someone's face. That we all agree to. A fingerprint is not as blatant as someone's face.
I think that it's probably more blatant because fingerprints won't be wrong one in a billion, and facial identity is very often wrong. A person puts on weight, loses weight, they get older, they get younger. Fingerprints never change. They're far more accurate than facial identity.
So I'll tell you the difference. The difference is this, is that you know fingerprints are accurate, not because you could read fingerprints. I'm sure you're talented and you could read a lot of things. Fingerprints, I'm a lawyer, and you know, when you go to court and you submit fingerprints to the jury, you can't just submit fingerprints to the jury and say, look at these fingerprints, they're the same, let's convict him. You got to bring an expert. Why is that? I'm just bringing a riot from American law. Why do you need an expert to come in and say, I'm an expert in fingerprints, this is his fingerprints? You know why? Because fingerprints, to understand fingerprints, see the person in the fingerprints, it requires expertise. Someone's face, when I have a photograph and I give it to the jury, I take a photograph out, I say, look, I don't need an expert. So I understand what you're saying, it's 100%, and there are more mistakes in face, but I'm showing you the eyes of the Hamonan. It is simpler and easier.
So let's bring in some witnesses then.
I promise you.
Who are experts.
I promise you, if I had a jury of the best jurors in America and there was fingerprints versus a face, 1,000% the pictures would convince everyone more than the fingerprints. Why is that? They're 100%. The answer is that in order to decipher a fingerprint, it takes expertise. That expertise is something that requires skill, requires knowledge, and is a science in itself. Even though we can read Wikipedia online and think we know about fingerprints.
So let me ask you a question. Rabbi, let me ask you a question. If you had a mace in front of you and they took the fingerprints and you had three or four or five experts, ksherim, two rabbanim were experts, they said, these fingerprints say it's Yecheskel. And then two witnesses said, no, we saw Yecheskel walking in the street, right?
Correct.
Would you be matter his wife to be married or not?
So when I matter, at the end of the day, there are poskim that are matter. But I'm just telling you the issue why some poskim are reluctant to be matter is because of this issue, is because of, we don't have a mesoyer for such a proof of evidence. And that's it. You know, it's 100% conclusive. What I matter at the end of the day, I might be matter. That is correct. However, it's not just as easy as to matter someone with a picture.
Rabbi, well, thank you very much, Rabbi Rappaport. It was very enjoyable speaking to you, very enlightening speaking to you.
Thank you. Bye.
All the best, Kol Tov.